Hello and welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey Karras and I'm here with Amanda Hayes and Kathy Lett.
G'day, girls.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
It's so exciting to have you with us.
Thank you.
And for those of you who don't know, Kathy is an author and she writes because it's cheaper than therapy.
So true, yes.
And she writes the way women talk when men are not around.
That's absolutely right.
Which I love that. And I've been reading her latest book, Best Laid Plans, and it does have that lovely tone of very the way women just chat to each other. It's got a really engaging, very funny book. I've been laughing out loud.
But Kathy, a woman of great taste and discernment, what can I say?
But Kathy's been writing since she was 17, the precocious 17, her very well-known book Puberty Blues, which came out in 1979.
I was practically a fetus, what can I
say? That's right. And shone a light on the surfy culture in Australia and was really one of the early feminist works. It was a really groundbreaking book and very, very like a cult, more than a cult hit at the time.
And I really just wrote it for my girlfriends, my surfy girlfriends, to explain to them that they were more than just a life support system to a pair of breasts. Yeah. I had no idea it was going to become this huge overnight sensation. It was kind of frightening to go from obscurity to overnight notoriety. And my mother's only just told me recently that she got death threats, and because she was a headmistress, and people would ring her anonymously saying, "What kind of teacher and mother are you to raise a daughter like that?" She didn't tell me until now because she's so lovely. But yeah, it was very contentious. There were two copies sold in every family. So, you know, the parents would be reading it upstairs going, "Oh, my God, is that my children?" And the kids would be reading it under the bedspread with a torch going, that's me. Double book sales.
It really struck a chord, didn't it? And it's also been made into a movie and recently a TV series in 2012. Yes. So it's got it's really endured.
Yeah.
And Kathy's, some of her other, she's quite prolific, but some of her other books Fetal Attraction and Mad Cows. I love the titles too.
Thank you.
Mad Cows, which was made into a film with Joanna Lumley and Anna Friels, and How to Kill Your Husband and Other Handy Household Hints, which was made into an opera.
I didn't get to see the opera,
but that's fabulous. Oh, I just love the idea of that.
It was pretty exciting. But a lot of famous operas were books originally. You know, Eugene O'Neagan and Carmen and all sorts of things. So there is a tradition, but that was pretty damn exciting.
And Amanda's been reading a more recent one, Courting Trouble, and I've been reading Best Laid Plans, which has the premise of a mother starts out with a mother going to find a prostitute for her 20-year-old autistic child, which is such a wonderful premise in so many ways, partly because of the scope for comedy, which you exploit.
I do.
But there's so much more to it, of course. And Kathy's in Adelaide for her fringe show, Big Night Out, which I saw on Tuesday and it was a full house. The audience in tears of laughter. I'll let you actually chat a bit about that perhaps. We could start with that. But it wasn't all laughter. There were some really touching moments as well, but it really was resonating with our packed house on Tuesday, I can tell you.
Well,
it's wonderful.
The whole reason I did the show is I wanted to celebrate female friendship because I think women are each other's human wonder bras, uplifting, supportive, and making each other look bigger and better. So it's funny, but it's also quite feminist, and I think the women watching get a little bit empowered by it all. And I say at the end of the show that, you know, I explain that I'm wearing a wonder bra and it's so cool because when you take it off, you wonder where the hell your tits went. and to never wonder where your female friends have gone, cherish each other, you know, let your cups runneth over with love, keep each other buoyant. Because I think what we've discovered with the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement is that the sisterhood is powerful. And if we stick together, we really can make a change. But only if the men join us at the barricades. We need them. Mm. We need them to help us get equal pay, because otherwise it's just not going to happen. So it's a kind of inclusive show, but it's a lovely way of meeting my readers, and it's so flattering to meet them, because the women who come to see the show are witty, warm, welcoming, wise, wonderful, all the W's.
That's sort of exemplifying what you're talking about, really, the solidarity.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's been really nourishing for me as a writer too. And also they bring me up little anecdotes they've saved up for me that I might want to use in a novel, which is so generous. You know?
That's brilliant.
And I write them all down. Yeah.
Like sort of outsourcing your ideas.
That's right.
Let them come to you.
Yeah. It's been a really great experience.
And Kathy, before we went on air, you said that there were quite a few men in the audience in Adelaide, and you don't find that so much in the UK. Yeah. So that's another good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I always say to the men who've come along that they will be ovulating by the end of the evening.
And they don't flee.
I think they kind of find it quite educational.
Yeah, I bet they
do. Because I feel sorry for them. You know, when men go out, what do they talk about? Sport.
Sport.
Cars.
Mm, yeah.
You know, and when women are together, we strip off to our emotional underwear, and it's a psychological striptease that reveals all, and it's incredibly funny.
Yeah.
I mean, when you go on a girl's night out, you have to be hospitalised from hilarity, don't you?
Yeah, and it's a tonic, isn't it?
It is a tonic. Yeah. And I make the point in the show that I think there is a difference between male and female humour. And my male friends are very funny. They have what I call the black belt in tongue fu, where they fire off one-liners and jokes. But women never do that. Our humour is much more confessional and cathartic, anecdotal and honest and hilarious.
Yes.
And I also say in the show how... it amazes me how many men still don't think women are funny. And when I go on book tour around the world, because I'm published in 18 languages, and so I've been to a lot of countries, and some male journalists will always say to me, oh, you know, you say you write funny books, women aren't that funny. And I always think,
really?
Why do some men say that? I think they're terrified what it is we're being funny about.
Oh, you know,
they presume we spend the entire time talking about the length of their members, which is not true, because we also talk about the width, you know, which after childbirth, so much more important.
That there was a line about that on Tuesday that the woman in front of me was on the floor with laughter.
I hope really she had a strong pelvic floor. Do your pelvic floor exercises before you come.
No, it was resonating.
But I do think women wouldn't get through their darker days without being able to laugh with their human wonder bras.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I'd be lost without my female friends.
And it's a really good thing to acknowledge and to celebrate, I think.
Yeah. And anthropologists back this up. Anthropologists say that women in all cultures on the planet laugh more often than men, especially in all female groups.
Really?
And I think if you can laugh at something, you take the sting out of it, don't you? And it allows you to sort of strap a giant shock absorber to your brain. So in my novels, and I've written 14 now, I always champion women. There's always a feminist storyline there, but I dip it in humour and sugarcoat it so that you have a lot of laughter along the way. And I do think that's the way women cope. That's the way we are with each other.
Well, as you say, it's writing as therapy almost and reading as therapy as well. Mm. So, and on to your books, the one that I've been reading and laughing out loud is Best Laid Plans.
Right.
Would you like to tell us a bit about that and what inspired the story?
Mm. Well, the story is actually inspired by my own son, who's autistic. And when you read, I've only written two novels that feature autism. One is The Boy Who Fell to Earth, and this is the second book that discusses the subject. And I wanted to address an issue that nobody ever talks about, which is special needs and sexuality. Mm. And first of all, you know, when your kids become sexual, it's a social, emotional and psychological minefield for all parents. Because
I'm going through it right now.
Okay, yes, you are. Because my generation had to leave home to have sex.
Yeah.
But now
or in a car, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, because men think sex drive means doing it in the car, But now that we let our kids have sex at home, over 16 obviously, it makes for some very awkward moments over the muesli in the mornings because you never know who's going to turn up. But when you have a child with special needs, you really never know who's going to turn up. Animal, vegetable, mineral. It can be surprising. And whenever you read books about, or you know, that have autism featured, the protagonists are always kind of to be pitied or they're inspirational. Mm. Nobody ever talks about their normal need for love and companionship. So it's sort of a taboo subject, and I wanted to address it. And it was really inspired by my son because when he hit puberty, I mean, he did everything to attract women, sort of bar covering himself in cupcake icing and walking through town with a free designer shoe placard. But to girls his own age, he was too exotic. You know, he might as well have been a sherbet-winged flamingo flying down the high street.
You think they were a bit scared, perhaps?
Yes, because they're you know, kids, teenagers just want to be accepted and be the same.
Yeah, of course, you know?
All that peer group pressure. So when he got to about 18, I mean, his self-esteem was so limbo low. You know, you need the Hubble telescope to sort of locate
it.
It was terrible. And I remember I came home one day and he was sitting in the kitchen. He said, "Mum, I am a reject. I am a retard. You know, if you'd known I was autistic, would you have aborted me?"
Oh, my goodness.
And that's when I thought, you know, I have to do something to help this kid. So initially I enrolled him in a dating website. But I let him write his own profile, which was a mistake. He wrote something like, "Come join me in my wacky world where relationships are at their zany best." He got one reply from an 85-year-old grandma. And all she said was, "Time wasters need not reply." So then I thought, well, what am I going to do to help him? And I talked to a lot of my women friends through the National Autistic Society, and they were having the same dramas with their sons. And they wanted to take our boys to a brothel. Now, as a feminist, that's a kind of drastic step to take,
isn't it? Yeah.
But also I thought, who's going to take them? You know, the mothers can't take them. We can't sit outside knitting. Yeah. It's like paging Dr. Freud to reception. Hello. And then I asked my male friends and they were like, "Oh, yeah, does the word divorce mean anything to you? Can you imagine?" And I asked my female friends if they'd take Jules and they were sort of horrified that I could even consider using a sex worker. And then in the end, I was driving through London one night coming home from an event and I was near Liverpool Street Station where the red light district is, and I swerved off into the red light district. And this is not my natural habitat. My natural habitat is like, you know, a bookshop or maybe a cheese counter in a deli or something. And the working girls are coming out of the shadows, but behind them are also their pimps, and these are scary-looking guys. You know, as a writer, the only wound I've ever received is like a paper cut. And I panicked and sort of went home because I thought, you know, I really don't want to be strip searched, not without dinner and a date first, because it is illegal what I was doing. And I'm glad I did, because a couple of days later I read in the newspaper about a father of an autistic son who was arrested curb crawling to pick up a prostitute for his
son.
Really?
Interesting.
And I thought, that could have been me.
Yeah.
So it kick-started a thought in my mind that this would be a great opening to a novel. Middle-class, middle-aged mum, arrested curb crawling.
Yeah.
And the Kafkaesque comedy, I can build around that while also making a serious point. So that's what got me going. But as I was driving home, I must tell you, driving home in the red light district that night, I did have a brainwave. I thought, who are the horniest people I know? I thought it's boys with autism who are priapic because they never get a girlfriend.
Mm.
And it's women post-50, post-divorce, taking HRT. And I'm like, why can't I put those two groups together? So, yeah, I want to write to Mark Zuckerberg and say, have I got an app for you? You know, I'm going to call it Or Tinder or Tinderism. Or what about this? Square pegs for round holes. Come on, it's gorgeous. So yeah, I have got another plan. But by the way, my son has got a lovely girlfriend now. She has special needs as well. So it's interesting. I know way more than any mother should know.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
But
yeah.
they're really happy. So there is hope out there parents of kids with special needs.
And were you involved in that relationship of your son's in finding the girl, or did he manage?
Luckily there's an agency in Britain called Flame Agency where it's kind of bespoke. They meet the kids who have special needs and they sort of matchmake them.
Yeah,
so
right.
And it's a really, really good idea. We should start something like that here because the social isolation for kids with special needs is truly, truly awful.
Well, and avoidable.
Yeah.
You know, if
you
have someone just giving them a nudge and helping them along the way. Yeah.
But in the book, are you halfway through yet? There's a really good twist halfway through. I'm not telling you.
I don't know if I've got to the twist.
There's a really good twist coming
your way.
No,
I must be nearly at the twist, I think.
I love a twist.
Yeah.
In a novel.
Yeah.
I really
can't wait now.
You'll be doing twist and shout. I'll have to get there.
I'll have to get straight back to it. And tell me about the process of writing the book and how you navigated that line between the personal story and fiction, because it's drawn from, I mean, you couldn't make up those experiences, some of those experiences, could you?
I mean, so normally if you're researching a novel, you have to go up Mount Everest or, you know, down, you know, through Brazil and down the Amazon or something. But it was interesting writing a book that was inspired by my son, because I just go next door and knock on his bedroom door and say, darling, what would you say now? And the joy of both those books is the language of the boy with autism. It's so inventive and colourful and original. And for people who don't know what autism is, if they're listening, it's actually a lifelong neurological condition, and its chief characteristics are an inability to communicate and socialise, often chronic OCD and anxiety, but also often a very high IQ.
Yes.
My own son's like Wikipedia with a pulse, you know. So there's a lot to celebrate about autistic people, and I always think, let's stop trying to change autistic people. Just let them be their best autistic selves.
Oh, absolutely. How did your son feel about your books?
Even though I am so candid and I talk about everything that's ever happened to me, I never spoke about my autistic son because I didn't want to invade his privacy. And when he was about 21, I started writing this other novel. It was a satire on the sex war, my usual literary terrain. And this other book started pouring out of the end of my pen about a woman raising a child on the autistic spectrum. And I thought, well, I'll just publish the book and I won't talk about my own connection. But then a journalist asked me, was it true if I had a child with autism? And I didn't want to lie about Jules, because that would look as though I was embarrassed of
him. Exactly,
yeah. And, of course, the opposite's true. I'm so proud of him. So I gave him the book to read, and he read it and said, well, Mum, it's a celebration of idiosyncrasies, eccentricities and being different. And I'm like, that's exactly what it is. Thanks, Jules. So with his permission, I very tentatively started talking about it, and I'm really glad I did, because it taught me that it's always better to shine a light into a dark corner.
Yeah.
And, you know, and every woman has something in their lives that's difficult and dark, because we're the carers, generally speaking. We care for our aged relatives, our fragile friends, our sick siblings. We take care of our children's needs, you know, many of which are special. So even if someone can't relate, they don't have someone in their family who's autistic, they can still relate to the emotional angst that the mother goes through.
Oh, yeah, you know, definitely.
And the humour she uses to get through that. And also the other thing I was going to say is the most interesting reaction from readers has been how many have written to me saying, I have just realised my father, my son, my brother or my husband are on the autistic spectrum. Because it's one in every 68 people.
Yeah, and it is a spectrum.
Exactly. So, and it's called an extreme form of maleness. It tends to come down through the male line.
Oh, it does.
There are obviously there are women with autism, but women are better at disguising it, and it does seem to affect men more. And so just think about the men in your lives. I mean, if he's a train spotter or a plane spotter or he's emotional bonsai and you have to whack the fertilizer on to get any feelings out of him, there's a very good chance he's on the spectrum. Not that I like to label people. I think but it's a cycle. Yeah, it's a psychological shorthand. It just points you in the right direction to get help, and also makes you a bit more tolerant and patient. Yeah, where you think, oh, they're not meaning to be taciturn and rude. It's just that's who they are. So, the point I try and make it with both with these two books that address autism is that, normal's just a setting on a washing machine, and a label something on the side of a jam jar. You know, let's not judge people for being different. Let's celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Difference.
In fact, one of my friends with an autistic son, he has just, as part of his year 12, has just published an audio book about how he navigates his life. And I listened to it. Absolutely brilliant.
Fascinating.
And my friend said she had nothing to do with the content. He did it all himself.
Wow. Well, we now know with diagnostic hindsight that Mozart and Einstein and Orwell and Van Gogh and Steve Jobs and all these amazing artists and musicians and scientists and mathematicians are on the autistic spectrum. So with the right help, they can give back to society in the most interesting way. But less than 15% of people with autism are in the workforce, which is a much lower inclusion rate than other disabilities. So we neurotypical people have to just learn, as I said earlier, to think outside the neurotypical box and not be so judgmental.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to ask what you're working on currently, but you have the show, which is, I'm sure, keeping you almost fully occupied. But knowing your output, have you got other ideas or other things on the go at the moment?
I've got a book due in June.
Oh,
and
right.
It's called HRT, Husband Replacement Therapy.
Brilliant.
And as soon as I say that title to women, they laugh, so I know it's going to be a bestseller.
your puns and plays on words, which are so clever, and Tuesday, you know, the being each other's wonder bra and all that sort of thing. Does that, it sounds so natural and it seems to flow from you. Is it hard work coming up with the language and then the whole book?
Do you know why I think I have this facility with words? It's because growing up as a surfy girl in Sydney with these beautiful beach babes who, you know, they sort of prove that Barbie and Ken dolls do have sex, and this is the progeny. They're 6 foot tall, long blonde hair, beautifully proportioned breasts, lovely long legs. You know, and I'm a 5 foot three brunette whose bra cups do not runneth over. And I think if I hadn't developed this, what I call quiplash, you know, the Pope would be ringing me up for tips on celibacy. I think I just developed this way of using words so I could get laid, basically. But also, when you are out with your women friends, we do laugh, as I said earlier, all the time. And if I say something that makes the other girls laugh, I do make a mental note to write it down if it's resonated. So, yeah, when I'm going out socialising, people think I'm just having fun and swinging off a chandelier with a toy boy between my teeth, but I'm actually taking notes. Yeah. I'm like Margaret Mead. Yeah, I'm in Margaret Mead mode, like an anthropologist on L plates.
I read in one of your tweets that you said you're a little scrubber from Cronulla, and I think we have some listeners who are not in Australia and they won't know what that means. So can you explain what that is?
Oh, well, that first book we were talking about earlier, Puberty Blues, was set on the beaches of Sydney, and the suburban beaches of Sydney, and the guys we grew up with disproved the theory of evolution. They were evolving into apes. It would have looked more natural if they squatted on their haunches and groomed each other's back hair for nits. And the example of sexism I always give when I try and explain what these guys were like, they used to get us to cut their names out in paper, sticky tape them to our stomachs, and then sunbake so we get a tan tattoo in the shape of their name. So if ever I get cancer, I'll have a melanoma called Bruce. I'll have to have like a brucectomy to get rid of it. So when I say a little scrubber from Cronulla, it means from very inauspicious beginnings. I've, you know, come to be the writer in residence at the Savoy Hotel and have lots of honorary doctorates, or whatever. And I left school at 16. I mean, the only a long way from Cronulla. The only examination I've ever passed is the cervical smear test. So it's quite heartening. So amazing. Yeah, I always say to girls, you know, I do like what Sheryl Sandberg says about leaning in. For too long, we've been decorative and demure, and all the research shows that if a man and woman start talking at the same time, the woman always pulls back. And I just want to say to women, be confident. You know, life's too short to be subtle. Just have confidence in yourself and seize the day. Carp the hell out of DM. You know, I'm carpe DMing like there's no tomorrow. Adventure before dementia is my motto.
Very wise words. And Kathy, what book is on your nightstand? Because we like recommending books too.
Well, because I left school so young, you know, I'm an autodidact. It means self-taught. Clearly it's a word I taught myself. Yeah. I tend to read the classics. Obviously, I devour a lot of books and I love a lot of contemporary writers.
Yeah.
But I am working my way through Jane Austen and the Brontes and Virginia Woolf and George Eliot and Edith Sitwell and Gertrude Stein and all of that. So trying to educate myself. But what's interesting, and I was talking about that in the show too, that whole canon of female authors we adore, that whole lot of literary lionesses didn't have babies. You know, books and babies did not go together. They gave birth to books instead of babies.
Interesting observation. Yeah.
And when I came to write, when I was pregnant and I, being a writer, I immediately looked to literature to reflect what was happening to me. I couldn't find anything, and that's when I realised that. So I thought I couldn't find a book that told the truth about childbirth, pregnancy, and motherhood, I would just write my own.
Yeah, exactly.
So I did Fetal Attraction and Mad Cows.
And is that changing now, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I do think it's changing, and thank God women don't pretend to be perfect mothers anymore.
Oh, no.
I think Mad Cows did kickstart a whole genre which we now call mummy lit, and women don't pretend to be perfect mothers anymore, but as I say in the show, a lot of them do pretend still to have perfect marriages. And I say, you know, perfect marriages are like orgasms. A lot of them are faked.
Yeah.
So I wish women would stop doing that and they'd start to be more honest about the trials and tribulations of their married lives. Because I think love may be blind, but marriage is a real eye-opener. And the trouble
sure
is, love prepares you for marriage the way needlepoint prepares you for round-the-world solo yachting. So let's just be more realistic about that. And I'll be doing that in HRT, of course.
But that's when it is so good to spend time with your girlfriends. Because that's when those stories do come out. And it's cathartic to hear, you know, that we're all having our little struggles.
Yes. I mean, no one should – don't try and pretend to be perfect about anything. Yeah.
No.
And the fun is in the faults and foibles. Yeah.
That's right. And, yeah, no one wants to read another person's perfect Instagram story of, you know, 13 years married today, I love him and, you know.
It's just vomit-making. It really is. I know. I wish women would stop doing that.
I know. And also because we're a podcast, our listeners always love a good podcast recommendation. Mm. And I think you mentioned earlier you've got a couple of podcasts that you listen to.
I really like the British podcast, the book podcast called A Good Read. And the premise is that three people come onto the program and we all have to recommend a book we love and we have to read each other's books. And then you discuss it. And it's very stimulating because, you know, you get all sorts of different people's comedians, scientists, artists, writers. And often we hate each other's books. So there's often blood on the shag pile in the radio studio.
Yeah.
But it's really – and it can be very, very funny. And it can also open you up to all kinds of – all sorts of genres you wouldn't normally explore. So it's a very good idea. I think we should do a program like that in Australia. And you two should host it.
We should.
For sure.
Yeah. No, it is. I've listened to that one and it is often quite a stimulating discussion. And, you know, you do get the guest who says to the other guest, thank you for choosing this book because I hadn't been aware of it and I, you know, it's changed my life. And
then you get the ones who say, I hate you. That book was 800 pages long. That's right.
I know. And some of them try to do it politely and others don't and they just come out with it.
I think the challenge now is to keep our kids reading because a lot of young people I know, their reading material is limited to their tweet and their restaurant menus, you know, their tarot cards or whatever. So and Netflix, of course, has been had a huge dent in all book sales.
Well, there are so many distractions.
So many distractions. And I would say give up Netflix. It's ruining your sex life anyway.
Yeah.
You know, really. There's better things to do in bed.
Yeah.
Well, I always say to men, you know, what do women really want in bed? Breakfast and a really good book.
Yeah. Well, on that note, more wise words. Thank you very much, Kathy, for joining us on Books on the Go.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Kathy.
Oh, I hope I didn't talk too much. They don't call me the mouth from the south for nothing. I think I'm on the Talkins diet, you know.
And we can highly recommend Best Laid Plans and Courting Trouble. And we're very much looking forward to HRT. Thank you again.
Oh, it's so nice to have Bill talk with my two human wonder bras. Yay!